federal funding issues. Pretty much knows everybody. We do have a new deputy of college who was here, and when she comes back, I'll stop and have her introduce herself. I don't have any announcements. Does anybody have anything that they would like to say before we get started? Okay. Any members? So, any comments on the minutes? Seeing none, is there a motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting?
That's what I'm doing.
And that's it?
Yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right.
Let me see.
You stepped out just nervous on the head. Introduce yourself. Why don't you tell us who you are, what your position is, and a little bit about your career?
Okay. My name is Lisa Turnbull. I'm the new deputy program director to Tom L. I'm coming from working for a large bank, running their real estate program management for the Northeast over the last 9 years. But prior to that, I did work for AECOM and we were doing some renovations on Dodger Stadium. I also worked on the Central Urban Project back in Boston, so I do have familiarity with large public programs, both programs. I am relocating from the East Coast, so I've been here all of 2 weeks, so trying to catch up and drinking from a firehead right now. So, but I look forward to working with all of you and on this program. It's a tremendous program from the community, and it's going to be fun.
Great. Welcome. It's much calmer now than it used to be, so you're getting in a great time. Jim can't be with us today, so Tom's going to do construction updates.
Okay. Between myself and Tom Donovan, who's our farm program project manager for the district. And I know most of you were here last time, but some of you may not have been here. So Tom started in December, and so he's fairly new too, but he's going to cover some of this. I'm going to cover some of the stuff. He's going to cover some of the stuff, and then we'll move on to a couple of reports. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is the total funding for the program was $6.27 billion. Anyhow, of that, 5.13 has been obligated, contracted. We got about 1.13 left to obligate, and of that, 4.72 has been expended. And so one of the things we're doing as a district right now is we're entertaining the idea of what it would look like if we would possibly go for another bond. And we had on the 27th of January, we did a presentation to the board talking about the needs that are still out there with the district. About 40% of our structures on campuses are still over 50 years old, and so there's still a good need for rebuilding some structures. A lot of it is getting older, and so we're currently in the process of we hired a company to do some polling to see if there's any support for that, and the campuses are starting to develop list of needs that are still going out there that we haven't addressed with these last three bond measures. So you may be hearing about that. Currently, that's not covered by this committee, but when we passed Measure J, what we did was we amended the DCLC committee to include Measure J. So if we were to do something like that, you know, this body would probably then become involved with the bond measure if we pass something. And right now we're exploring the idea of what would it look like if we went in 2016 or if we went 2018. but we're looking at this fall, possibly. So just a heads up in case you hear something in the community. Currently, we have completed 230 of 400 planned projects, and we have about 35 projects in construction right now, and about 67 projects in design. We had, the last time we talked a little bit about the lease-back, we're still working on those contracts, trying to figure out which way we're going to go with those contracts, so nothing new to report on those right now. We are set, though, to address that in the next couple months. Other procurement updates, March 2016, we have Southwest School of Science and Math. It's a design build project that we will be awarding, and it's about a $13.5 million project. We also have the OSEP for which we will go to the board in March for approval. In April, we have Los Angeles College, the exterior transportation and accessibility improvements package, and we're looking at that probably in April award. We've got pre-qualification services. And I think this is for moisture intrusion. And everybody says El Nino is still coming, you know, but whether it does or not, we won't know. But we do have some standby contracts that we've been developing so that if we do have emergencies, then we can address those.
Is this like stabilization, stuff like that?
Intrusion. We've had a couple issues on some of the buildings where we've had some moisture. And then one, we have a pretty serious problem and settled with the contractor on replacing the outside exterior in one of the buildings. So it's sort of a combination of addressing some older buildings and as you said, doing moisture protection, slope protection.
We only have one new building that has moisture problems, or do we have one?
We've had some over the years. Some of them have been settlements that we've settled with the contractor, but we still have yet to get the contract in place. Like Allied Health Valley, that building, we've got a contractor that's lined up, or we're going to have a contractor lined up soon. But we had to wait until all the legal stuff settled. But we did some temporary repairs, but it's going a couple of years now since the temporary repairs were done. So if there was a possibility of something, with heavy rains, we haven't really been tested with heavy rains. We tested with rain, but not. And we got at Bandy Camp, we got a roof there on one of the buildings there, that the bakery building that we're currently in litigation on, that we're may have to do some protection if it starts raining. So then there's a building in East LA with the 4 yards that we had some water intrusion at one time, and it's on the side of the building. So we did a settlement with the contractor, but we have yet to apply the product. And one down at Trade Tech also, but on the child care center that has the same outside wall type problem. We settled with the contractor.
Is stucco walls?
There were a couple of ephes. There are problems. Some of the older buildings.
So anyhow, it was on them.
When you say moisture, a lot of times you can turn in the mold. We don't have that issue where got it earlier.
Well, we did have one issue that we got, but we got ahead of it. It was at Bandy Camp on the new education building, and we'd already taken the walls off, dried it out, and put the kids' bikes up, but we still have some So we do still have a few things out there that we're working on, but this would be contracts that, you know, if it looked like we're gonna have issues, that we could call the contractor out and not have to wait for all the red tape to get something there. So these are like standby contracts. So then in May, we're looking at expanding our architects and engineers bench. And so that'll be a May award. And then the OSUP, we have that also in May. Some good news, there are 17 projects in active construction, scheduled for completion in the first 6 months of 2016. So we have a DSA handout, and Tom was going to talk about that just a little bit.
I think there is some good news to report. Statistically, LACCD has done very, very well and has made a concentrated effort actually over the last 5 or 6 years to try and close any projects where we haven't had certifications through DSA. Right now, as we sit, about 89% of what's been constructed under the bond program is certified and closed. We have 8%.
You should have a handout.
We have one over here. Yes.
Okay. So we'll go ahead.
I should have referenced that. So 8% are active, meaning they're under construction at the present time, and 3% is what we're working on, and that's around 31 projects. And, part of the challenge in some of these projects with DSA, some of them are very old. There's three of them that are very, very old that are actually predate the bond program. And we're also trying to work through, they have some architects of record that haven't signed off, and some minor details that, again, they're on our list, and we're going to try to close them. But that's in that 3%. If you look at some of this,
the percentage is done by dollars or by projects?
By projects. By projects, yeah. Good comment. So if you look historically on slide 4, we summarized the years and the amount of progress that we made. You can see since 2013, we had 29 projects closed with a value of $160 million in 2014, 55 closed and certified, almost $700 million. And 2015, last year, 56 projects closed, $560 million. So in the last 3 years, some very, very good progress. $1.4 billion, 150 facilities. The next slide talks about the numbers at each of the particular colleges in 2015. You can see the 56 that are indicated on the previous slide, what that distribution was. And I said there were 31 projects, and we listed where those projects still exist that aren't certified. We have an action plan for every single one of these, and hopefully, again, over the next couple years, we're going to bring those through closure. We're working on various elements with DSA on what the gaps are. I was going to make a comment. If you look across some of the education programs in the state of California, we've done some research, and LACCD by far, and there are lots of double digits in the 40s or 50% in some of the districts that haven't made it through the certification process. So it's very, very high on our agenda, and
and obviously we're committed to making that list of 31 go away by the end, hopefully, of the, this fund,
I was going to say, so these numbers are through 2015. I just got a note from our DSA closeout specialist yesterday that we're down to 24.
Wow. 2016.
So she's done about one a week so far this year, whittling down that list from 31 to 24.
And then the last page gives some history with the graph. And, excuse me, I mentioned that. You know, the bond program in general really started focusing in the 2006-2007 timeframe, and you can see the tremendous effort of this reduction. And what you see in the years going forward is not to represent that they won't be certified, it's just the number of additional buildings that we're going to put through the program that are targeted, obviously, to be closed and certified. I said historically there was a lot of bundling, so what would happen is I might have four or five projects together, and four of them are ready for certification, and there's one issue on one of those projects that keeps the four open. So we're getting smarter about making sure that we're putting projects together that will allow us to go through the certification and not end up like historically has happened, that we have some issues with one project that keeps a bunch of them from not being certified. So I think it's a good news story, and again, we're committed to, as Dan said, I hope we can do one a week, but difficult. So anybody have any questions about the certification?
Well, actually, I do, since she said that she's been 1 week. Wouldn't that actually count?
Almost different for every single one.
Is it a paper review or is it a physical review?
Well, it's both.
It's a combination.
There's an inspector that comes out and looks at the building to make sure that it's built with in compliance. There's sign-offs by inspectors. All the files of the forms from the architect to the DSA and the contractor have to be completed, saying that everybody's done. And if one of those little pieces falls by the wayside, it can hang up a certification.
Even a change order is not approved and signed off by everybody.
Somebody didn't sign the right piece of paper. So it's anything from things not being built correctly to the paperwork not being filed correctly. When you finally get approval of the project, you jump through a lot of hoops. And, I think it speaks well for this program. If you compare us to the rest of the state, and the state architect, Chet Whittem, has said time and time again that we're the best in the state as far as closing out our projects. So even though it looks like there's some projects to close out, we're far better than other agencies.
Right, and I have a list. Everything that's missing for every single of the 24. Okay. So we have a little action plan that we go through, and everything that's missing, we move along that action plan and try to move it to the finish line. So
the compliance person. Our compliance person, she's been working with us since about 2005.
The spike on the chart is when she was hired.
I was just commenting on the job.
Boy, tough job.
Going through all that stuff, especially if they're old.
Well, and
trying to get people to sign stuff.
Well, and some of our people have passed away. Architect of record.
Yeah, for some of those.
Or moved out of the country.
Like the architect? Mm-hmm.
So, sometimes it's hard to get those signatures, and you got to file other forms in order to get to hire an engineer to come back and look at it.
We don't have anything that's falling far behind it now, do we?
Well, there are a couple that predate the bond program I said that we're trying to work our way through.
No, I'm talking about
the new ones we're doing now.
Goes through the process of closeout and then gets certified while it's still alive and breathing in Southern California.
Yes. Right.
Okay. We've been working really hard to that. In fact, one of the things that we've told architects, if they don't do their work, then we're not going to give them any more work. And so that's put a little bit of a
motivated and time to get, the work done. So we haven't had as a, we put them on, we will not receive new work, and if you don't do your, finish your closeout process. So if they're the holdup, they know it, and their company knows it.
Aside from the closeout, do you evaluate the work of the contractor and determine whether they're going to be bid, allowed to bid?
Absolutely. There's a, evaluation of every single element of the work that we do on the programming side for architects, engineering, and design side, and contractors. We're evaluating them as they progress through the work, and then there's a final evaluation that goes into the database. That so if there is a situation where contractor or a vendor, some other vendor is not performing, we know that when we go into subsequent procurement. So yeah, we keep a very detailed record.
Just as an overview for somebody at like 25,000 feet, we have a whole lot better contractors now than we did when I got on this board, I don't know how many years ago. But recognizable names of guys who've been in the business for a long time.
It's helped.
Yeah. So if we don't have any more questions about DSA, we'll move on to some other good news. And
We one of the things that we've done in this program, and we've tried to amplify it even more from AECOM's perspective, is that we have a very robust internship program, not only at the college level, and we were able to take advantage of a grant program, H-1B, that allowed us to hire, and it's peaked at about 14 or 16 people. It's sunsetting in March or April of this year, but we're out actively pursuing other opportunities to extend the grant. So all these people come in from the LA Community College District, and we put them out on campuses. We have a rotation program where we try to get them exposed to finance and quality and health and safety. AECOM has made a commitment to continue that program through the summer of next year, fall of next year, with another 8 or 9 positions. And we also have a high school program called ACES, where we actually have high school students that have an interest in architecture or engineering or construction. And you know, we bring them in on a sort of part-time basis and have them participate in the program. Most of that's not done out at the construction site because obviously they're younger people, but you know, we're really looking to continue that program. It's been very, very successful. We have about 50 students in that high school basis program. I wanted to talk a little bit also about some other good news. I think you have the list of construction projects that we have underway right now. And really, from sort of the end of December until the end of June this year, we have some major projects pretty much across all of the campuses, about 17 or 18 projects that are completed. And it's around $220 million worth of work if you add up all of those projects. Out at City here, we've completed the physical plant, the tennis courts, this home stall modernization.
In the home stall modernization was one of those projects that was a troubled project in the past, but we
captured it,
yeah.
and got online. It's going to be finished, you know, by the end of March. And the Student Services Center here is looking at a May finish, about almost $40 million. And then we have some traffic mitigation work that's also ongoing at this campus that's going to finish up by the end of June. A very, very big project at East is looking to finish the new campus student center bookstore complex. At Harbor, we have another three or four projects. You know, the largest one sales is late 2017, but there are some other projects going on there. At Mission, there's a couple projects that are going to finish this year. One is just about to be turned over. It's the phase one of the modernization work that's being done out there. Pierce, again, you see two projects, 30 million finishing. And on the next page, again, in the second quarter of this year, a couple, three or four projects that are fairly significant that are finishing. Valley, we have two very, very, or actually three very, very large projects. If you haven't seen the new student union out at Valley College, it's I think it's really a signature architectural piece. We actually had a regional meeting out there a couple days ago, and the folks that we brought from other campuses were just amazed at that piece of architecture and the use. The ATF, athletic training facility, also finished in the December timeframe. We're kind of punching out some of those elements, but for a person who played high school sports or and college sports, for a community college to have you know, that those assets is just a tribute to the program. That's a wonderful athletic training facility and new baseball and softball for men and women, new football field. It's just spectacular. So we're pretty proud of the things that we're completing, and again, speaks highly to the program. And our, and Dan mentioned the contractors. Honestly, we have a great group of contractors, and the Pankows and the McCarthys and Balfour Babies of the world have done a great job. And you know, we're the good news still, although you know, we're a little concerned about escalation on this program. The one that Tom mentioned, it's going to be starting at Southwest. We were within the budget for that project, so we're trying to be optimistic, because we have good contractors that have worked here, that we're going to continue to get these projects for a reasonable price, because we still have quite a few.
Prices open pretty steady?
Well, they are starting to increase. I think we were fortunate, and this is, you know, some of the strategy we're trying to use is, because we have these pre-qualified contractors, a lot of times it can be advantageous that they're working out there on another project. So in that particular case, Harper was out there, and they were on the pre-qualified list. So, you know, between the first their low bid and the next was only 6%, and between the second bid and the third bid was another 4 or 5%. So, you know, it was a pretty close range, but because they're out there, you know, they were given some advantage of mobilization and experience and know-how. So, but again, it's something that we're worried about, quite honestly.
We just before this, we were with the union members upstairs at another meeting, and the operating engineer said they have 27 cranes in the air right now downtown building. You know, so it just means that things are really coming up as far as construction, and we heard the reports from all the different unions on the apprenticeship program and their people that are on the bench. Not many people. You know, I know David, you can probably speak to that. But
we're picked up dramatically. We're bringing in, classes we've ever did, I think, in the last 20 years. Putting a lot of veterans to work, they're coming back.
Did a lot of people leave, though, in 2008 and not come back?
I think a lot of people retired. I mean, it's kind of scary. I I'm eligible to retire, but I'm not going anywhere. But I would say a lot of the unions have their membership is the retirement age. So
that's
happening. You're seeing that in all the different industries, too. It's not just in the construction.
Yeah, so the economy definitely is picking up in the construction area. You know, so I think that's going to be a trend for a while yet.
At least 2 years.
After
that, I can't say anything there.
Yeah.
Part of mine.
Can I ask you a quick question? So, there are about 23 projects on this list, and I think there was an earlier comment in the meeting that there are 35 projects in construction. What's the difference between the 35?
Well, a lot of those are smaller projects. You know, we have a lot of infrastructure improvement type work, and we have some modifications and some renovation to existing buildings that are a lot smaller. So those would make up the difference. Yeah, I've tried to keep an update to what the major projects that are underway are.
Okay. I'm going to go move on to some challenge projects. We have a few challenge projects yet out there that we're still working on. We had some admission college and had some campus remodeling of rooms and stuff. And one of the challenges we find is when we get in there, we start tearing down and putting the updates in, we find, you know, things like firewalls that were never put all the way to the ceiling like they were supposed to be, and a few of those types of things. So it's been a little challenging because that project continues to keep finding things that we need to work on. So
right, and the codes have changed. So when you get into one of these older buildings where it doesn't meet the present code, you have to go keep chasing sprinkler systems and electrical plumbing, piping, all of those things have to be addressed. So it can really turn into a significant challenge.
Another project that we've had trouble getting started is it's called the VAC. It's at Valley College. It houses their performing arts and media arts and a couple other groups now. They've incorporated some others, but when we got the bid in, that came in a little bit higher than their budget, so they've been working on that, trying to get it within budget, and it looks like it's getting pretty close now.
When you need to get something like that in budget, do you take it back to the user groups at the college and say,
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and some of it is just value engineering, the true value engineering, that it's not just cutting something out. Like an example, one of the things that we look at, you know, is the type of finishes and is it readily available and how much does that cost? And like on this building, there was some sheeting for the outside of it that was coming, shipping from
Europe,
New Zealand or Australia or somewhere, yeah. Which, you know, really added the cost. You know, the architect that designed it had designed a product like that. So we were looking at, okay, can we get something locally that won't cost as much? And you know, so those are some of the things that we really take a strong look at.
Don't let the press know that we're getting siding from New Zealand.
Well, we're not, but it was, you know, when somebody specs a certain look to the building, you know, a lot of times you don't know what that cost is until you start putting, you know, the pencil on paper. You know. Another one we've had some work to be done with challenges: the harbor old administration renovation, and that one was. The sizing of the project, the amount of dollars, and so it was a little bit of a larger project than they had dollars, so that we had to do some rescoping on that. And then we had a central plant that, where was this at, Dan? The central plant was at?
This was the Valley.
Valley College?
Yeah.
That was, okay. We had some, reported that as previously as a delay, because we had a bid protest, and that protest has been settled, so it's moving forward again. So that's it's still going forward now.
Yeah, out of my memory of that. At one time, there was an issue with SETI-TEC about an auditorium. It was historically significant, whether we wanted to tear it down. You couldn't afford to do anything, but you couldn't keep it the way it was. How did that ever get resolved?
It hasn't yet. It's still sitting there. The building itself, it doesn't really have a historical ranking to it. You know, we had a good dude we had come out the other day and look at the site. Somebody with the CEQA came out and looked at it, and they said there is no historical significance to it. We still have to, in order to close out another project that we had on the attached buildings with the Division of State Architecture, we have to address the wall that's common between those. Whether we tear down that building or whether we leave it in place, we still have to address that wall. And so that is still a point of discussion. It's still going on. It's not, the only thing that's holding up right now is the certification of the other projects that we have on, you know, because it's not dangerous, locked up, you know, nobody's in there.
Big job.
It's a big job.
Big walls, something here, big foundations right on the corner, two busy streets, so.
Just bring it down.
Bringing it down is going to be expensive also, yes.
So it's still in discussion, and that's gone back to their user groups. Okay. I think we're ready for estimation.
Yeah, I think you all have a handout. Put together a presentation on estimating. We made this for bond steering, and I think we also discussed it at MPOC. It is a very important part of this program. I think there are, the fact that the program is more centralized now than it was in the past, that you had these individual colleges collecting information. Right now, everything that happens at every single campus is brought into the program management office. So we have a tremendous database of what the construction costs actually end up being. But for every single one of the projects that we do our own estimate. We do our own basis. You know, it allows us to track and monitor the cost of information that comes back from contractors. It gives us a real baseline to be able to make decisions. And again, when we go into these value engineering programs to try and address budgets that are over what we're expecting, it allows us to have some real-time information on various elements of the work, so we can determine what the impact of making changes might be. So, and I'm going to show you some information on the actual settlement with contractors when they come with change orders. Because we've aggregated all this cost information, it allows us to sit and discuss in detail with them all elements of their pricing. So if you go to the next page, with the estimating success, we have a summary of...
which page? There's several.
Four. Page four. There's a...
Four. Slide
four. Okay, slide four. Estimating success. You have a summary, so it looks like this.
Looks like four's missing. I think we're missing that one.
Yeah, that one.
Oh, the one at the top.
Yeah, and I know it's hard for you to read, it's even hard for me, to read here, but what it is...
Historical?
Historical? Okay.
How did that come up?
Slide five.
Slide five.
Yeah, you left out slide four. Well, slide four and slide five, slide four, I have a slide that summarizes a group of change orders that were first presented by contractors to us that gives, it compares the original price that a contractor provided in his original change order submittal to the PMO, and the $13.9 million, $14 million is the difference between the original summary of change orders, $57 million, I think, and it represents a 35% saving over the original cost. In other words, the contractor came in and was asking for X, and we settled with Y. The only reason that we were able to settle with Y is, again, from having a central estimating department that's aggregating cost information from all of the projects that we do and establishing a baseline. And, you know, a lot of the work that we do across these campuses is not that different. We do, obviously, 16 or 17 trades. So we have excavation numbers, we have concrete and foundation numbers, we have mechanical, electrical, plumbing numbers, structural numbers, and so whenever there's a change order, we spend a lot of time with our estimating group doing our own estimate, understanding the cost, and then sitting down with the contractor after and saying, okay, we don't agree with this unit price for a certain element of the work, or we don't agree with the material price that you have, because guess what? I've done seven or eight projects over the last several years, and you know we believe that you ought to be using a more aggressive number.
How does the timing work on this? They submit a change order. Obviously, the work needs to continue on.
Yes.
Do we go through this whole process before we authorize the change order?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So
yes.
That can screw up the job. There's no way to approve something subject to working out a mutual number.
No, but you know, there's the process is, and what we want the process to be is that the contractor recognizes in advance that there's some change. Okay, he's monitoring his progress. He runs into something that he believes is a change. He submits a change request. We're processing, and we have key performance indicators that we measure our success. In 60 days, we would have resolved that issue. That's our target. So he would not have gone more than 60 days without an answer. And then obviously, as soon as we get the change order, it only takes us, because we have an estimating group, you know, maybe 3 or 4 days to look at, okay, what are the elements of the change order? We would say, okay, we agree with this change order, or we disagree with this change order. If we agree with the change order, obviously he's going to go ahead and work with the work, but we're going to negotiate the price. If he doesn't agree with the change order, he has to continue with the work, and he can file a claim after the work is done to try and recover his cost. But it's a real-time evaluation, and again, the larger contractors, because we have larger, more sophisticated contractors, and because we've been doing this, it's pretty standardized, again, it's not our intent as the management organization for this program to have contractors in a situation where, A, we don't say, okay, we agree, it's a change order. And in fact, we have the change orders broken down into three basic circumstances. One, unforeseen conditions. Two, owner-generated changes. And three, design-related changes. So we have a pretty sophisticated platform. And again, for me, that's one of the advantages of having a program management office where we can collect all this information and evaluate it. So
we don't
been pretty successful.
We don't have any of the craziness of like LA Building Department, do we?
No, you know, our if you look at the amount of money that we put in place, you know, I talked about all these buildings that we finished and certified since 2013, whatever that number was, 150 pretty significant projects. And Tom talked about the claims. Our open claims are, again, looking at the total number of projects that we're doing are pretty good.
What I'm talking about is that in the change order process, especially in the city of LA, especially city of LA Fire Department, they come through halfway through the project and go, well, I know we signed off on this in plan check. We don't like any of this. You got to do this. We don't have that.
No, we have three types of contracts.
We do have that. We do have that because we have inspectors. They're DSA inspectors that show up on the side. And the inspectors will find something that maybe is, even though they signed off on the plans, that maybe isn't the code. And
then their current interpretation of the code.
Yeah, well,
some of it,
and we have talked to the Division of State Architecture. Sometimes you have inspectors that step outside of their bounds a little bit and want to make comments about things that really aren't, you know, it's more, it's not going to code, it's more a matter of style. And so sometimes we do have to get interpretations from other people at the DSA.
That's a change order.
It
could be.
Could be.
Could be. Or listen, you know, there are some situations where we have architects that are under contract that we expect to know the current code. And you know, if there are issues with them not designing elements to code, then, you know, we go after the architect. They should be designed by...
We basically classify our change orders, and we're doing a study on that. Probably at the next DCOC meeting, we'll have a report for you on that. We actually are putting that together right now, and we're going to talk to the board this March on change orders, which was expressed from the board, one of the board members, that we go back and revisit. But we started classifying the work orders into, you know, what is unforeseen conditions, you know, like, you know, it's not as the as-built were, and you get into there, it's behind the wall.
Renovation.
And you can't see behind the wall. Another one would be an error or an omission from an architect or engineer. And then there's the ones that, you know, are user group owner requested, you know, scope creep. And those are the ones that we really try to tighten the screws down on. You know, they should be telling us before we start the project, you know, what they want in that project. And then once that happens, then we shouldn't have to go back in and keep tweaking because that costs money. You know, so we really are trying to compartmentalize the types of work orders or change orders that we're doing, and so we can get a handle on that. But we've really, you know, made a concentrated effort to let people know that we just aren't going to approve everything.
So. Okay, and then you know, I talked about on slide six, it has some comparison of you know, what the recent bids were. I mentioned that we do an estimate every time we go out to a group of contractors and vendors, and obviously we're comparing our estimate against the range of estimates that we get. So you see some recent bid results, and it has a number of bidders, the low bid, the high bid of what our estimate was. And you can see in general, we're pretty darn good, again, because we have all these statistics and we're keeping these statistics up to date. And it, you know, it helps with budget, it helps with planning. You know, the next slide that you see.
Excuse me, how can we only get one bid on something as big as the Trades parking store? $26 million, half a million, you got one bid.
But that might, I think that that is done, lease-back or design built, okay? So it's not a procurement-type contract. It's, we negotiate the price with the contract, we do the estimate, and so he's the only one giving us an estimate for the job. But, you know, on the next slide, estimating is occurring at all these steps, okay? So when we get into programming, we'll have a description of what a project is, we'll do an estimate, and then we get to a schematic design, 60% construction, DD, 90%, 100% construction. We do estimates and keep updating it, and then again, at the end, we take all the information that we have in our base and put the actual cost back in so we can prepare the next project. That's similar. And again, as you would imagine on the next slide, the estimate's going to improve as we get more information. So you might have a wide gap at the beginning where you're just programming, and then it gets refined over and over again. We use a lot of information like square footage price and unit rates, and so we again have this database. In the budgeting phase, obviously, we're looking at trying to make sure that what we expect to build can be done for the budget. If it's not, we have to go back and look at it again. And then these next slides talk about the various stages that were on the previous slide about you know, the information, the improvement in the information, and the improvement of the estimate. Slide 11, the CSI Institute, I mentioned earlier that we have 17 or 18 major categories that we break down the cost into. And again, we categorize those and keep them as a matter of record. Obviously, when we get to 100% design documents, on slide 12, obviously that's all the information we need, and we use that again to evaluate the contractor's bids and to help us make a selection. During construction, I talked about the change order process and our use of the estimating information to negotiate with the contractors to make sure that we're getting a fair price for all those change orders that we believe are valid. And then, again, on the closeout side, the last slide, we're taking all this information, updating it against the actual cost, and keeping it in the database. You know, again, for me, it's a very, very important part of the program. I think having a program that's managing across the nine campuses rather than having individual campuses really allows us to have a valid and solid database in the program. It's a real saving for that effort that we can measure. So I don't know if there are any other questions about the estimation.
Does this allow us to see how prices are increasing?
Absolutely.
Because we've got unit costs per unit.
We do. We have unit costs, and I said, you know, on the job we just bid, about $15 million. We were right at the budget. You know, I think it's a design build job, and the budget's $17 million, and we're 16.7, so there wasn't a lot of room, but it does certainly help us look at trends over time.
So I think you can see from that we have a pretty extensive process in trying to
make sure we get a fair price.
Make sure that we're not overpaying, you know, and make sure that a contractor is underbidding the project, you know, and then we're going to end up with a lot of, you know, claims, changes. You know, so we're really trying to make sure that we're not paying too much but not paying too little either, you know, and just the amount that we should be paying. So it's pretty impressive for all the work that goes into putting these bids together and putting those bids together.
I assume it kind of keeps contractors honest, but I know they're not just going to get in.
Absolutely.
Either I'm signing off on it or I'm going to leave you. Good, thank you.
So the next thing is there is the slogan that says fuck out. And we wanted to bring this to this group to start talking about this because it's something that's going to be more important, something that is budgeted for in a bond program. And so I asked Tom to put together a little PowerPoint that we can talk about what's going to happen with that, so you kind of get an idea of what we're doing.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's another wonderful element of this program that we have embarked.
We should have a handout on that.
We have embarked on a renewable energy element of what we're doing out at the campuses. If you look at page two, we do have 10 freestanding PV solar photovoltaic systems. At five of the colleges and one of the piece of property.
What is freestanding, not on a roof?
No, on a roof. On a roof or on barn. A lot of them are over parking carports or maybe the top roof of the garage in a carport. But again, they're not ground on them. None of them are ground on it. And there's a good picture if you. You go to the third or the fourth slide, but most of these were done in 2000 and between 2007 and 2010. We do have one or two projects that will be completed over the next couple of years that will also have one element of another element of PV, but they're all operating. Now, there were two types of agreements that were entered into as part of this PV system. One is, it's called a power,
Is this security cameras, things like that? Is that what you're talking about?
No.
Okay,
this is actually solar power.
Renewable energy.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Solar panels, a whole bunch of solar panels.
Yeah, we've got a lot of them on the parking lots there.
Yeah,
we do. We have time.
So there were two types of financial arrangements for these projects. One is called the power purchase agreement, and that was the first one. The other nine projects are all solar leases. And so the one that we are asking the board to make a decision on is actually the power purchase agreement, and that's where a provider actually comes in and acts as the utility. So you're actually buying the power from them at a predetermined rate. And when solar energy first started in the 2005-2006 time frame in the country, and it really started to be sort of the way forward for renewable energy. There were a lot of grants and there were a lot of federal tax credits associated with it, and that's why you saw a lot of people get into a power purchase agreement. Quickly, the solar industry and this financial mechanism sort of hit dead end in a couple of years, and then most of the projects are like the ones that we have in 2009, 2010, and they're solar leases.
So, just so you know, we only had one project, and it was the power purchase, and that was the
ELAC.
That started in 2007,
right.
And so it's the first one that's going to come up for a buyout. The rest of them will be all the solar leases. And Edison allowed you to do power purchase. Yeah. LEDWP did not allow power purchase. So that's why we ended up going with a lease agreement. But then we thought the lease agreement was better than the power purchase anyhow. So then we extended it to the Edison territory for the rest of the
right.
So some private individual gets the tax credit since we can't use it.
District doesn't pay federal tax.
Yeah. Well, you can monetize them, but a lot of times part of the deal is they redo reduce your costs if they can keep the tax credits.
No, I understand. But we can't use them, so.
But if we have the tax credits, we could sell the tax credits, yes.
If you want to get in that business.
Yeah, if you want to get in that business.
You said that East LA has a power purchase agreement.
Yes.
So what's the buyout?
Well, that's what we're going to get to. I'll tell you what the buyout is. We have a couple slides on the buyout. But there's a photograph of the rooftop on the parking structure. That's the array. You can see it's pretty sizable. So on slide five, that is essentially the buyout summary. For the first 5 years, there's no option. And we're actually in the second year, year seven. That's what's in front of the board and likely to be a decision to exercise the buyout. And the buyout value, you can see in the second column, is about $3 million. If you add up all of the costs, which is in the last column, you can see that the total cost, if you continue to pay the annual capacity charge, would be about $8.7 million. So obviously you're looking, there's some value of buying this out. The reality is that we're right about at the break even where the existing utility price that we're paying to the utility for the rest of our electricity is about the same value or just a little bit less than what we're paying this with Chevron Energy, was the leasee. But if you go into the next 13 years, their value goes up about 5% a year, so you end up paying a premium.
Can I just ask, we bought solar, we own the solar for our house. Why is it the leasing is better instead of just buying it outright and selling it?
I can speak to that, because the reason we looked at the leasing piece of it is because there were certain incentives, tax incentives, that if you install this, that the district can't use. So the companies that installed this, they got the incentives for that. So if we leased it from them, they could use those incentives that the government was giving. But we, as a public entity, it was not going to save us any money, because we couldn't use the incentives.
So we're doing it because they have to service it and everything?
Well, the part of that is, for the first 5 years, in order for them to use those credits, that first 5 years, is what you have to use it in. So after that, then we can buy it out, and then they monetize all those credits, and there were also some incentives, to early on in the program from the utility companies to put these in, we did get some incentives, like this project, I think it was $2.3 million that we got on this project itself as an incentive to do the project.
But this is power purchase.
This is power purchase. But in this case, we don't actually own the array. But we couldn't do that in the LEDWP. They wouldn't let the power purchase agreement work there.
So is the goal then to purchase all of this eventually?
The goal was to purchase it, but to utilize all the tax incentives, sure, tax credits, and everything out there before we paid off the bill. And so we had to set it up in a structure that we didn't own it to begin with, or we were leasing it to begin with. And then after that happened, after a period of time and all those incentives were done with, then it made sense for us to buy it out.
Yeah, no, that's great.
And it also, with the solar lease agreements, the lease payments can be made with bond funds.
Oh,
so it's not coming out of the college's operational funds. Which is another difference between the power purchase agreement and the solar lease agreement. Once you buy it outright, it becomes college operation.
Does the lease allow for purchase after 5 years?
Yes.
Yes.
So the goal is to purchase.
You could purchase.
Because
those will be coming up.
Most residential deals don't allow you to buy it out.
The only piece that we couldn't charge back is maintenance and operation. And that was the piece that the colleges pay, but they get the electricity for free. So that's the offset for that is, you know, they're getting a lot of electricity for a little bit of that.
No, that all makes sense.
Right, and so, you know, if you look at the increased price and you do the math on the buyout and the cost of electricity, you're going to end up with probably somewhere around a $3 million savings. So only in this particular case does it really make sense to exercise the buyout. Now, the only problem that we do have is that the buyout can be used with bond funds, but only for the fair market value of the array. So we're in the process right now of determining what the fair market value of the array is. In the next 2 months, we'll have that number, and there may be some offset, some need to go get the gap from some other source. But again, the reality is, and I think everybody would realize that since 2007, the difference in solar for your house is tremendously different than what's here. The cost of panels and the cost of the solar have decreased by 10 times.
Well, not when we bought it, but yes, it has.
Yeah, by 10 times. So.
So, and the reason we're talking about our purchase this time is because that's the one that's coming up. You know, that was our first deal that we did. You know, the leases, we will still, getting this in front of you now, you know that, you know, the leases are going to come forward, and we'll talk about those as they start to do.
So again, there's a couple pages on the facts of the size of the system, and as Tom said, the fact that, you know, we're going to buy it out. There's some information on the O&M costs, which are going to have to be picked up by the college when we exercise the lease, and it's around $30,000 a year. And then there's some statistics on the remainder of the ones that are in lease and when the decision might be for you know, looking at a buyout. Some of those are up this year and next year.
What sort of life span do you think these panels have?
Well, this one's been in play since 2007, so it's still producing electricity. We've looked at the efficiency and, you know, the operational efficiency, and it's still up in the mid to high 90s. So it's producing today, you know, what we expected it to produce. So, you know, you're almost 10 years, you know, I would say, you know, maybe you saw the lease term is 20 years in general, so the expectation was 20 years.
The reason I ask is I renovated it on my house, and I did a 20-year lease, and they said that's what we do is 20-year leases, because that's what we think they're going to last. But quite frankly, we don't know.
Right.
Which, for a company that is a professional solar installer, it's kind of an interesting.
Well, that's because we have like 20 years worth of use, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, this system, like Tom said, is 10 years old, and the degradation hasn't been that big. And these are some of the early panels.
Right.
So the later panels
will be better.
You know, the efficiencies are better, so I don't think you're going to have as much degradation. But you're going to end up, you know, probably getting 25 years out of them, you know, I would imagine.
I mean, let's face it, Southern California, right? You don't get a lot of dust. You don't get a lot of rain. You know, if you took a topographic and climatological area, where you're going to get the longest duration, this is a big spot. Because those are the kind of things that, you know, wear on the cells is...
And,
you know, if you get a lot of dust, I mean, in Saudi, you would expect with all the sunlight more than here and the temperature more than here. But their problem is it's always, the wind's always blowing, and you're getting accumulation on the panel, and it, you know, it grinds on the panel, so this is a great spot to have it. So I'm with him. I think 25 years you're going to get. So,
and I asked the question, also I'm not an energy expert, but I asked that same question, and I was told using that present value calculation, you would need a degradation of more than 80% before it's not worth.
Not useful.
Not useful anymore, and that's a couple of decades.
What's the most damaging over time is extreme heat.
Yeah.
And so when we started looking at this, and Dave knows this, because IDEW helped us evaluate the panels, and there are different classifications of panels. You know, so you can get a C-class panel, a B-class panel, an A-class panel, and we spec the top panels when we did this, because, you know, some of those panels were not the same quality, and, you know, you just couldn't trust them. But we did inspect the top panels.
What's our goal within our budget of what sort of percentage of the electricity we produce for the whole system?
10% of the district's electricity produced by a renewable source, such as solar.
I'm sorry, you said 10%?
10%, yeah, and that was the goal set by the board when we started the bond program. So, and we're there. I mean, we've got over, we got 10 megawatts of solar on the ground operating.
The average electricity has been going up 6% a year.
And that will continue forever?
Yeah, yes.
The price of natural gas has gone down, though.
Yes.
You know, because of the new methods of extracting gas.
But you'll notice your electricity bill, even that generated by natural gas, has not gone down.
Yeah. Like the price of gasoline.
Yeah, right? So. Okay. So if you don't have any other questions about the photovoltaic, I think we're ready to move to the Chancellor's report. And Dr. Burr is here.
Yes. Unfortunately, the Chancellor couldn't be here this afternoon. He asked that I sit in for him. You know, he, when he, make these reports, he likes to, I say, cover the waterfront, kind of talk about more than just construction. So I think he would probably start by saying that our spring semester is well underway. We have looked at our enrollment and noted that it is soft, and that means that we're going to be reaching our funded target by the state. But we always provide a higher target for ourselves so that we can capture growth from other colleges across, you know, so whoever leaves money on the table, we are able to capture. And this year, we set a goal of 4.75, and we're not quite at 4%. So we're still soft in terms of our enrollment target. Enrollments are soft throughout the state, and that's because the economy is good. The economy is good, people are working, they're not in school. And that's generally the way the cycle goes. So we still anticipate that because we have some short-term classes starting that will make our goal, but we're looking at it very carefully. So that's in. I think he would be very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have extended an offer to a person for director of communications and external relations. This is a position that was eliminated from our staffing table about 7 years ago. It took us about 5 years to bring back, and our first recruitment effort was not successful, so this is our second recruitment effort. We think we're going to be able to engage a very highly talented and skilled director. She comes to us from having worked at USC and more recently with the county health department, so feel very comfortable about that. I'm not releasing her name yet because I don't have it in writing. At this point in time, but We hope to have her on board in the next couple of weeks. The board this week interviewed for the position of Vice Chancellor for Financial Administration and Resource Development. Chancellor had looked at three candidates, recommended an individual with lots of experience, lots of community college experience, and we hope that the board will approve that recommendation on March the 9th. And that brings me to what is happening at our colleges on March the 9th, and that is that from March the 6th to March the 10th, we will have about 120 individuals from throughout the state visiting our 9 colleges and our district, the Educational Services Center, for accreditation. This is the first time that accrediting agency will be looking at an entire district in this manner. Well, we are the largest district, and because we are, in the year 2000, ACCJC determined to go on evaluate our colleges on a regional basis. So since 2000, our colleges have been on a 6-year review cycle, but that meant that every 3 years we were having an accreditation visit. And that meant also that every 18 months we were either hosting a follow-up visit or submitting reports. So from a board standpoint, they were always seeing and receiving accreditation reports. Every single year, we had one of our colleges or two of our colleges were submitting some kind of report or receiving a team. This time, all 9 colleges, and for the very, very, very first time ever, there is a district review team. And so we will have about 11 people at the district. We will have teams of between 12 and 15 individuals at each of our colleges. They include trustees, chancellors, presidents, vice presidents, faculty, business officers, technology folks, facilities people. So it's going to be a comprehensive visit. Tom has been placed on notice that he may have to chauffeur. We have a person.
That's you, right?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Oh,
we get that a lot.
I'm sorry. So sorry.
But to go along with that, they probably will be visiting the bond program.
Yeah,
too.
No, right. Understood. Mm-hmm.
Do they want anyone from this organization?
We don't know yet. They have not sent us an interview list. We have, generally that list is sent to us 2 weeks in advance. We've been asking. Have not received it. We've been promised that we will have it on Monday. So we will know on Monday if they want to, if they wish to interview anybody from the District Citizens Oversight Committee. They are going to be looking at the build program. They've asked to, they have a person on the team that's a facilities person and who has indicated he wants to visit every college. For us, that seemed kind of overkill because each of the college teams is going to have a facilities person. They're going to be looking at facilities at each of the colleges. So we told Tom Hall to just be, on call. I mean, we don't know if that is in fact going to take place. We're encouraging conference calls and video conferencing as much as possible. So, looks like there's a conflict with the room schedule?
No, they're just going to show you around. They're
showing up
great. To help out with the tour.
All right, okay, so I'll make this quick because the only other item that I wanted to talk about is the fact that East LA College is planning a ceremony to mark its opening of its Academic Student Success Center, its Student Union, and its Quad on May the 5th. I don't have all of the details on that, I know that they've already started some of the legwork on it, but they thought that the three projects coming together with the Quad And it's actually an area where a month ago, the board's Blue Ribbon panel on campus safety and emergency preparedness had a press conference to release its report. And it's, you know, the Academic Student Success Building is said to be the largest of its kind for a community college. It's really just fascinating and great architecture just to look at. But I'm told that it's quite functional and everybody's really happy with it. And then to somewhat related to that is the fact that about 3 years ago, I think it is now, Town Hall, we had a consultant come and do an assessment of our food facilities, and food service facilities throughout the district. In this district, sometimes, you know, we do things and then go, oh, we made a mistake, we need to go back. And we did that with this one, in that we did not do any kind of surveying of our employees and our students in terms of what kind of food service do you want? Or what do you, you know, what are your preferences? What are your desires? And what is the cost that you're willing to bear for any kind of food service? So we had done the survey of facilities. We went back and issued a request for proposals last year, conducted a survey. So now we have data. As I've told everybody, we had anecdotally, we already had the information, but now we have the data. So we have the data from our students and from our employees. And, you know, so basically they want grab and go. But the reason I'm mentioning that is that we are getting ready to develop the scope of work for, I don't know if it's a request for qualifications or exactly what the vehicle will be, but we're going to be working with Tom, I guess the two Toms,
yes,
in that,
yes,
regard, because we're going to have to develop a proposal for food services that takes into account the facilities that have been built or will be built. And I think the student union at East qualifies in that arena, that there's some rudimentary kitchen or some facility that's attached to that. So we're moving along, and I think that we're quite pleased with the program at this point in time, and I'm open to any questions you might have on any of those topics or any others. Yes.
I personally am glad to hear about the food services. It's been a tough point for,
yes,
Pierce.
At Pierce.
Because, well, there's no fast food around it.
Right.
So the kids either bring it in or there's a little tiny coffee shop, and that's
right.
But it's been a disservice to our students. So I'm glad to hear
that. And Pierce does have has some facilities built in already.
A great facility.
Yeah.
It's just sitting there. So,
right.
But the kids need it.
Right.
You know, they really do. So good.
Is there any thought we have an outdoor, outside vendor, like Subway or something like that, running for us? Or is,
well,
that
I think the idea is that we would issue a contract for a large vendor to provide food service, and that if that's the case, we probably would need to staff it with at least one person internally as a manager. But what we're really talking about is contracting that service out. Because, so that what we're looking at is that a vendor that can come in that can bring in several brands and not just one, because I think that's what our
but
what we're
looking. But as opposed to a company that does institutional food service,
exactly,
which
no,
is given a bad name to,
right,
institutional
and
food service.
Absolutely, yeah. That's more what we're looking at is if we can get some brand names. That's what we would like to do, but we're. It's probably not going to be what we call cafeteria food.
Would it be
that's
one vendor or like a food court?
I think that's going to vary by college, and that's why we're looking for, if we can identify a large vendor like Sodexo or something, you know, that provide, can customize for each of the colleges, because what's needed at Pierce is not needed at East. I mean, you know, East is, you know, East is probably going to be grab and go something, you know, because that's what's available in the vicinity as well. And it wouldn't make sense for us to do anything more than that. But I can see that there would be something different at Pierce.
Pierce is all set up and ready to go. We have a beautiful building with a place for Chinese, a place for sandwiches, a place for hamburgers, and it's sitting there, right. And our kids have to carry lunch into school.
Right. And the problem at Pierce, too, is that if you get in your car and you drive, and this came up repeatedly, was they lose their parking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So
that's
a problem.
Also, we have facilities. We should be able to deliver food cheaper than, I mean, the average Subway spends a fortune for their location. And if we're, you know, if we don't want to, you know, charge rent, we could have cheaper food, the same food at a cheaper price for the students.
Well,
unless we do want to charge rent, I don't know.
No, part of it is that we have to be careful about that, because this is also bond funded. And so we have to look at the facilities that we're using, and I don't know all the legal stuff on that, but I do know that we have some restrictions.
Yeah, so you just can't build a piece of property out for a company using bond dollars. So it'll probably be some kind of a joint use.
Some type of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Yeah.
I did have one thing that Ann asked me earlier before you got here. The status of the vacant positions for the DCOC, and I know the chancellor's working on that.
Yes, I believe he made a solicitation, and he has received resumes. At this point in time, I'm going to guess that they're not. I don't know that they're going to be on the March 9th agenda, a board meeting agenda, because we haven't received them. And.
But they could be on the April agenda.
They could be on the April.
And then that would make them eligible for our April DCOC meeting, which.
Yeah, because we either have to do something about six being a quorum, or we've got to get ourselves staffed up.
Absolutely.
We're kind of on the thin edge here.
Yeah, so.
The next meeting's April 29th, so. Hopefully, our board meeting's earlier in April, so hopefully he'll have people on board before that.
Do we have a bunch of people starting to get close to being termed out?
I don't think so.
We've got a few. We have a student trustee that will have to decide whether we're going to put a new student on. Dan, in August, you, I think, termed out. We just renewed David.
Yeah.
And so I'll have to look at the rest of these, but I think we've got a little bit of time
on
some of these yet.
Yeah.
But,
I think it's the vacancies that we have currently. So he did make the solicitations, but my sense is that the reason I know that they're probably not on the 9th is that all those items were due in my office this morning. And I didn't receive them, so.
Okay. But at the next meeting, I'll bring you the list so you know who's.
So we're replacing a lot of people in about a 6 month period.
Yes, yeah, unfortunately.
We have this whole cycle thing that seems to happen about every 2 years or so. But there's a few that are off cycle, which is good because it carries the continuity of the committee and board. And those that haven't served the full 6 years, we'll probably keep asking if you want to serve another two, you know, until you get 6 years.
Yeah.
You know, so that'll be coming up for those of you like David. You know, he's on his last term, you know, so, and Dan's already on his last term.
Okay, old business, new business. We are adjourned. We are now
going to
tour.
Yeah, so this card, so one side of the map, this the route that you will take. The other side, you know, the other side.